Welcome to Don't Pass Me By with your host, Bob Wilson. We bring on an author of a very interesting set of books and other works as well. He's a well-known podcaster, the acolyte of our old friend John Barber, and he's got a Beatles book coming up. That sounds interesting to me. Welcome to the show, Don Jeffries. Hello, Don.
Hello, my old friend Bob. How are you? It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
It's a pleasure to have Don Jeffries on the line today, and I have to start out by asking, tell us about this the center of your body of work. I believe would roam around or the Hidden History series of books. Tell us about this Hidden History series and how you came to begin penning them.
Well, I still consider myself more of a novelist, but I had one novel published, The Unreals, and I haven't been able to get the others published, even though I think they're really good. But so I just said, well, let me try nonfiction. I know the JFK assassination, that's my wheelhouse issue. Started researching it when I was a teenager, so I said, well, let me write a book, but I didn't want to write a book just about that.
Why,
So I wrote a book.
Don, you're a pro. You're leaping ahead here, Don. We want to get to that. We want to pick that apart like we're picking choice
Okay.
cherries from a tree. We want to hear about the Hidden History series, not your failed attempt at nonfiction.
Okay. Well, no, the Hidden History, the first one was the first Hidden
These were a
History.
big hit, folks, a big hit. Now
Yeah.
start with those.
Yes. So the nonfiction books did much better. So I said, well, I'm going to keep writing them. So I've gotten five more published, and another, including the second Hidden History book. It's Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776, 1963. That's kind of the prequel to Hidden History. It should be Hidden History 2, but they didn't want to call it that. And Hidden History 3 I have finished and is with the publisher now, so hopefully it'll be publishing that. So those are the ones that seem to sell as opposed to the others. And obviously JFK assassination is still my wheelhouse issue, and it always seeps in there. So there's lots of Kennedy, not just JFK, JFK Jr. and RFK and everything else. The Kennedys are permeate all throughout these Hidden History books.
You seem more comfortable with me talking about those few books that didn't sell. Would you like me to go into that as a topic?
No, let's stick with Hidden History. Let's
Hidden
go with what
History
the
has been
people
on
want.
many, many bestseller lists. Which ones did it come in on? This was a bestseller. You're telling me about your
Well,
fifth grade term paper that Mrs. McGillicuddy didn't like. We want to hear about the hidden history there, Jeffrey.
there you go. Well, Hidden History, and the first one is still my bestseller. It's done really well, and that's Hidden History, an exposé of modern crimes, cover-ups, and conspiracies and cover-ups in American politics. And people can still find that out there. It went through, I think, three editions, and starts with the JFK assassination and goes up through the Obama years. It was actually published before Trump even hit the political scene, so we'll have to address Trump, I guess, in Hidden History 4.
Who is this
But
Trump you speak of? No, I kid. Keep going.
yeah, some ex-reality TV star, I think. But,
There you go. Now, obviously, JFK got you hooked. That was the bait on the hook that you initially jumped onto like a hungry trout. But
that's
what
correct.
issues after JFK, after you started researching that? Which things came to your attention when you said, I think, maybe I'd like to write a kind of a conspiratorial view book? I have JFK. What else did the mind of John Je Don Jeffrey start looking into? What were you delving into?
Well, when I was back when I used to be a voracious reader of books, before the internet, I just read actual books all the time. I don't do that so much anymore because I'm so busy online. But so what I would do is when I
And if any kids
had.
are listening, that's professional author Don Jeffries is advising you not to read any books, and you can become as big a hit as he is with the Hidden History series. Reading is no longer fundamental. Please continue.
No, it's just a reality that people just don't read as much anymore. So, I mean, luckily, my books have done as well as they have. But so I'm busy writing so much and researching that it cuts into your time reading other books. But I still manage to. I still probably read more than the average person. But back then, I read just an incredible amount. And what I would do is I tended to go towards the same book, the true crime type of books, but anything that, you know, was had to do with conspiracies and, you know, political intrigue, corruption, and all that, I would devour those. So what I would do is I would take notes from these books if I thought that I thought were really interesting, and I kept file. You know, before this was before Microsoft Word, we had I think it might have been before Word Perfect. I know I had one on Word Perfect, but before that we had like a dummy where you had mail. You know, if you remember kind of, that kind of mail you could get before you could send like a mail between each other on a system before email. It was just like an interoffice system. So I was able to have like a library that way using Unix software, and I would just type these notes out. As I was reading the book, I'd have that file up, and if it was something interesting, I'd just type it in and list the source. And
did you say Unix software? What was Unix software?
Yeah, Unix. It's, well, Unix
is really missing in Unix, that
answer. Unix operating system is that's a much better operating system than, you know, Windows, let's say, or Apple. But it's like an old-fashioned system, and all your main – whatever big mainframes that are left usually are Unix-based. But they had, like, their own language and everything, and they would have what they call trans libraries. So you'd have like email. Basically, you could send each other messages that way within the system you were working in. And they also gave you, like, a kind of like a Word. It wasn't – but you could write. And so I would write there. I would start writing the Unreals there, things like that. And I would keep libraries of notes of these books, and, you know, they accumulated a lot of them because I read a lot of books. And
I'm glad that you keep plugging the Unreals, because I don't believe it's any longer available, is it?
No, it is still available. It's still available. You can still get the Unreals.
Now, where can people get the Unreals? I did not know this.
Well, the Unreals had the first edition. I don't think you can get it. If you get it, you might be able to get it. But I don't get any money from it if you do, so don't buy that one, the white cover. Get the one with the gray cover. It's the same book, and that's the second edition, different publisher. That's definitely available. You can get it out there anywhere you buy anything else, Amazon, you know, Barnes & Noble, whatever, online. And Wherever fine books are sold. So, what I was doing that was also, like I said, taking notes, and then I kind of put in the back of my mind, maybe, you know, I'll use this to write a book someday, a nonfiction book, but I didn't really think so. I don't know. I didn't know there would be a market for it. And but once I decided, I'm going to write something, and I think I called, I can't remember what the title wasn't in mystery. The publisher gave it that. I can't even remember what the hell I called it, The Greatest Conspiracy or something. I can't remember. But anyway, I just started, you know, putting it together, and I said, well, I'll start with the JFK assassination and write a lot about that. And I had tons of notes about that, and I had my own experiences, you know, working as a volunteer with Mark Lane's group and having met Harold Weisberg, just, you know, long time, you know, reading and writing and researching this stuff. So I had my own personal stuff I could put in there as well. So, but I said, you know, this is, I don't want to write just another JFK assassination book because there's so many out there. So let's, as you know, the difference between me and most of the people in the research community is that a lot of them tend to just think this is a standalone thing, that JFK was assassinated, but all these other things, you know, these crazy conspiracy theories. Well, obviously, I don't think that. So immediately I could, you know, segue into Martin Luther King and RFK. And then Hidden History, I think the most important feature of it is that I was the first one to launch an independent investigation of what I think was the assassination of John F. Kennedy Jr. So it's got a nice section on JFK Jr. I talk about Chappaquiddick. I mean, I think Teddy Kennedy wasn't in the car that night. I think he was set up. So I talk about all the Kennedys pretty much. And then I just talk about the 60s and the fake counterculture with people, CIA agents, admitted CIA agents like Timothy Leary and Gloria Steinem leading it. And I talk about how it's very relevant now, considering January 6th, we know how many people were planted there in the crowd and were probably the instigators of whatever happened. It goes back a long way, and I talk about the history of the FBI and other law enforcement infiltrating, you know, the Black Panthers and the KKK and groups like that, and how Malcolm X's bodyguard was a government agent, as was Fred Hampton, the Black Panther shot, and Martin Luther King, one of his close aides, the guy you see cradling his head on the balcony of the Orlando Hotel, was a CIA agent, undercover CIA guy. So I talk about all that. And then after I get beyond the 60s and the Kennedy stuff, and I go into everything else. I talk about all the body counts for all these people, Reagan body count, both Bush body counts, obviously the Clinton body count. So I have sections on all these things that happened kind of a timeline during. So I talk about October Surprise, Iran-Contra. I talk about all the Clinton, the litany of Clinton stuff, Waco, Oklahoma City, all the people that Vince Foster, all the people that died mysteriously, a lot of the things that have been forgotten with Bush, the Gulf War, and then all the way up through Obama. Obama had a body count as well. So people have told me, well, I forgot this. I wrote about Lori Klosutis, you know, the aide to Joe Scarborough that back when he was a congressman, it was found dead in his office with a head wound at 20-some years old, and nothing happened to the guy. There's been no reporting on it. So people like that because there are things like that that nobody else is covering, and they say, well, I forgot about that. But there's I still probably left some stuff out, but there's a lot of stuff that fit into it.
Now, you began looking into all this and ended up in the offices of Mark Lane. Regarding the JFK case, I believe he was there early on for the slain Oswald, who didn't have many people speaking up in his defense. Could you please tell us more about this Mark Lane?
Yeah, well, Mark Lane was there right at the beginning. He was a New York assemblyman. He was a young Democrat, and he was the chairman, I think, of New York Democrats for JFK. And there's a famous picture of him, you know, getting his picture taken with JFK. So he knew him, at least on some level, but he was a civil libertarian, and I admired that about him. And as you know, I still call myself a civil libertarian. There aren't very many of us left. So I really admired that. And but from the very beginning, he wrote a brief, basically a defense brief for Lee Harvey Oswald early on that was published. He couldn't get his stuff published in America, but he got a lot of stuff published in England, because Bertrand Russell was over there leading quest for truth, where you didn't have that here in America. But then he most significantly was hired by Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, as the attorney to represent the interest of her dead son before the Warren Commission. And so he actually got to testify before the Warren Commission. And when you're reading those hearings and exhibits, as I had, most of it is dry, most of it's uninteresting, but one of the few witness testimonies that's worth reading and is entertaining and informative is Mark Lane's testimony.
Now, later, Mark Lane got involved with Jim Garrison down there in New Orleans, the district attorney who was featured as the prominent character in Oliver Stone's JFK. Could you talk a little bit how Mark Lane got involved with Jim Garrison and what transpired down in New Orleans with these fellas?
Yeah, well, before that, Lane wrote Rush to Judgment, which was probably still, it's still one of the all-time best-selling books on the JFK assassination, and it got him a lot of college speaking engagements, a lot of radio show appearances, not so much television, because even back then, they weren't letting these guys on, the critics of Warren Report, on there very often. But so it was natural for him. All the critics went to New Orleans with Garrison, and they ended up being, as you might expect from this dysfunctional research community, they ended up kind of becoming fractured. So you had a really good critic like Sylvia Marr, wrote Accessories at the Fact, who turned on Garrison. I don't know why, but she did. And others did, including Harold Weisberg, who's another one of my heroes. But Lane was loyal to him, and so were lots of others. And he helped him out there. So he helped work, you know, he did, well, I'm not sure exactly what he did, but he, as far as he was investigative, arm for Garrison, and he helped him out as much he could. So, and I think, you know, later on, I think he was pretty satisfied with the way Oliver Stone portrayed it in JFK, though, unlike Weisberg, who was bitter and jealous that he wasn't in the film, and more importantly, wasn't the hero. He thought he should have been the hero instead of Garrison. But I don't think Lane, I don't remember hearing that he was jealous about it, because he certainly could have mentioned it, but I don't think he did.
So he went down, he helped out Jim Garrison, but Garrison, there's something else about Mark Lane that I found very interesting. Without Mark Lane going down and filming some of these witnesses, it seems a lot am I correct in assuming a lot of the witness testimony, witnesses said, my testimony was changed, it's not, notary wasn't right, present, things to that effect. I didn't say these things, it's not my signature. I digress a bit. But Mark Lane seemed to capture these people on film for posterity. So he did a great service for history, did he not, to go down to Dallas and different places and locate the witnesses who got to go before the camera where it wouldn't be as easy to interfere with their testimony or change their testimony. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And he really, the credit should be, I mean, Lane obviously did a lot of investigating. The interviews you're talking about became the film Rush to Judgment, which was pretty much suppressed in this country. And it didn't really become popular until like the 80s when you could buy VHS. I have a copy on VHS, you know, that I got then. That's when they started making it available. But, you know, they didn't show it on television or anything because it has some very important eyewitnesses that he tracked down. But he had help. And, you know, one of the main helpers he had was Marguerite Oswald. And Hidden History 3 coming up, I'll talk a lot about how she was really the first conspiracy theorist, so-called conspiracy. She was the one that pointed these people, and mainly Lane, because Lane was working, you know, as the lawyer for her son. And she pointed him towards some of these witnesses that he found, like Akilah Clemens, you know, who was one of the witnesses that saw two people, and neither one of them was Oswald, shooting Officer Tippett, and other people like that. But
So in other words, the official story for maybe our listener who hasn't heard that one before, you're saying that they blamed Oswald for shooting Officer Tippett after Kennedy had been killed. Could you go into a little bit of this scenario for someone who might not have heard it before? In other words, Oswald's on the lam. He's not yet accused, I believe, of they're looking for someone to pick up. What happens? Tell us how that transpired.
Right. Well, you know, from my standpoint, like I said, the people that investigated this, and they didn't investigate. And that's the thing, what you need to know if you're out there listening, you don't know that much about it. The crime of the century was what pretty much called the 20th century is what people pretty much call the assassination of John F. Kennedy, was never really investigated. It was never properly investigated by any authoritative body ever. The Warren Commission was not an investigation. It was a prosecution of a dead man using basically a very incomplete and shoddy FBI report. The rest of it was padding. So Elaine, what they used the murder of Officer J.D. Tippett, who had some questionable connections himself, but we still don't know. You know, there's even people, and I don't necessarily disagree that it could possibly be. Maybe his murder was entirely unrelated. Who knows? But there was, once the officer was shot, and they claim, again, that Lee Harvey Oswald left the Texas School Book Depository at 12:33, which is 3 minutes after the assassination. No evidence for that at all. None. No witnesses, nothing. They had to have him leave. That's the earliest they could possibly have him leave, have any kind of, you know, believability at all to get him to where Tippett was shot. They had him go through this crazy series of actions that make no sense. He interacts with a bunch of dubious witnesses that would have been torn apart on a witness stand. He eventually ends up in Texas Theater and supposedly sneaks into the movie without paying, even though the only person there, the front clerk, Julia Postal, did not see him enter. I take it so, but that's what they tell us. And eventually you have, right after that, you have a slew of agents, including, you know, federal intelligence officers, and people that had no business there in a situation where the president had been shot elsewhere in the city. There was nothing to connect this guy to the assassination at that point, and yet they descended on that theater like with a swarm of officers at all levels, and very, very questionable. And it's kind of amazing that Oswald made it out of there alive. But that's the story is that he shot a police officer, J.D. Tippett, on the way there. And again, the witnesses there are all dubious. I mentioned Akilah Clemens, who saw two people, not one, and neither one of them looked like Oswald, according. There are other people that, the same way, you know, that Warren Reynolds was shot through the head. Initially, he couldn't say it was Lee Harvey Oswald. He was shot through the head and he changed his story. Yeah, I think it was Oswald now. You had Eddie Benavides, who was the brother of Dominic Benavides, who was shot and he was mistaken identity and killed. So Dominic changed his story as well. So Helen Markham, you had to read her testimony to believe it. Just, again, she would have been laughed out of any courtroom. She did not make any kind of an identification that would have stepped in court. But this is the so-called evidence against Oswald. And they used that to say, well, he killed a cop. And I don't know how many people over the years I've talked to as well, you know, when I would say, you know, he didn't kill JFK, well, he killed a police officer. And no, he didn't. You have to look at that case too, but you have to make people confront the evidence. The bottom line, there's no credible evidence at all against him in the case, in murder of Officer Tippett, much as there is no credible evidence against him in the assassination of JFK.
Well, say for your younger fans or your youngest fan, like our, I think your youngest fan might be Maverick Mize. So we would want to first, we want to advise Maverick that reading is not fundamental. He should see the Rush to Judgment movie, not bother with the book. Now, when he sees the movie, and Maverick Mize doesn't bother with the book. I kid. But you bring up such interesting points. Now, for our younger listeners who might not know the case, or our older listeners who just might be ignorant, who knows? They listen to the show, anything could happen. But no, you have a no kidding around. Officer J.M. Poe said he initialed the shells that he found at the scene. And then when he was shown, you know, to testify, are these the shells? Yet he says, my initials are not on them. Could you talk like a little more about something like that? Like, this seemed to be an occurrence that happened repeatedly in the case, where once they get somebody into court and they're under oath and their testimony is being recorded, that it seems very different than the official story or the myth, we'll call it for argument's sake, that seems to be being sold to the public with very little opposition other than in the beginning, your friend Mark Lane.
Right, and there's every bit of the evidence is tainted. None of it could have been, not any evidence in JFK or Tippit, none of that evidence could have been presented in an honest courtroom with a competent defense attorney. Because the first thing they would have done, because just for, simply for chain of possession problems alone, as you mentioned with the Officer Poe, and you also had the question of two different wallets being found at the scene of the Tippit murder as well. The slugs not matching each other. I mean, there's just so many questions there. With the Tippit thing, which is obviously in JFK's case, you had the alleged murder weapon, the Mannlicher Carcano, was discovered on the sixth floor of the Texas School of Depository where Oswald worked. And it was discovered hidden between some boxes. But the problem is that the officers who signed, who discovered it officially, who put this piece of evidence into the record, started the chain of possession. But Seymour Weitzman and Eugene Boone both signed separate sworn affidavits that the weapon was a German Mauser, entirely different rifle. So if I'm the defense attorney, the first thing I'm going to do in that courtroom, I'm going to say, okay, Your Honor, I'd like to introduce these sworn affidavits of the officers who found this weapon, and said, arrange for a mistrial, go for a mistrial right now, because this is the murder weapon, and you see here that the people that this chain of possession, you can't just somewhere after that just say, no, actually it was a Mannlicher Carcano, we were mistaken. That's not the way it's supposed to work, and a real lawyer would have recognized that right away. You didn't both, I mean, even if you both made a mistake in the exact same way, that taints the chain of possession, because now there's no sworn affidavit for the Mannlicher Carcano, the Italian rifle that you claim was used to kill the president. So that's the first thing that happens, and there should have been a mistrial, right? There would have been, now there wouldn't have been. You and I both know it would have been a corrupt courtroom. There would have been a prejudiced judge, and Oswald probably would have had a lawyer like Death House Riley that Bruno Richard Hauptmann got back in the day, or James Earl Ray's attorneys, or Sirhan's early attorneys. That's what Boston Bomber's attorneys, alleged Boston Bomber. That's what happens in these high-profile cases. They get awful attorneys who don't fight for them. And in this case, they probably would have done the same thing. But in an ideal world, looking at the Perry Mason would have jumped up and immediately said, Your Honor, I'd like to, rule that this weapon is not admissible. And an honest judge would have looked at it and said, yeah, sorry, where's the chain of possession for this? What's the prosecution going to say? There is no chain of possession. Same thing with all the shells, something like that Poe was talking about, but it goes for the alleged magic bullet. For those who aren't familiar, there was a bullet that was found, we think, on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital. And I've written a lot about that. The providence of that, of the discovery of that, is very much a question, even as to who discovered it. And, regardless, this bullet was found and just claimed to have fallen from Governor Connally's stretcher. Governor Connally was Governor John Connally was sitting in front of JFK in the limousine and was also struck by gunfire, but he survived. So there's no evidence where this came from, but the bullet, and I've documented the hidden history, the first hidden history, I talked about the laughable scene there. You had O.P. Wright, the head of security, who they were trying to interest law enforcement in this bullet. It passed through so many hands, we have no idea how many people handled this bullet. And very few of them initialed it. Again, everybody that handles that that very important evidence is supposed to document, so it doesn't, so that it doesn't get lost somewhere along the way where it can be corrupted. That's the whole idea of chain of possession. They didn't do that, and it ends up going back to Washington, D.C., in the coat pocket of Secret Service agent Richard Johnson. It doesn't seem like a, you know, standard operating procedure. And later, when Vince Palarello, the expert on the Secret Service, interviewed Johnson and asked him, hey, what was it like to carry the bullet back? Johnson claimed he didn't remember. Now, this is a Secret Service agent. I mean, that's going to be the highlight of your career, right? You know, grandchild, back in my day, I carried the bullet that hit the president, President John Kennedy. I carried it back to D.C. in my coat pocket. You think that might be a story for your grandchildren? This guy claimed he didn't remember. So this case is replete with that kind of stuff. And that's why it continues to attract people like you and me. For me, it's had a hold on me since I was a teenager. So you're talking about, you know, almost 50 years now. And it's never going to let go. I mean, it is what it is. It's a part of my life. It's an obsession.
Excuse me. Now, many times when we've talked, you brought up an interesting subject. It kind of led to Mark Lane, the woman who brought him in. You've mentioned her a little bit today, but she really has a more fascinating story than the attention it gets. Could you tell us more your thoughts on Marguerite Oswald, and for the people who maybe aren't familiar with her at all, a little background, so they, I'm sure they know that's his mom, but, you know, the deeper things and the details of perhaps how he came out of the Marines to take care of her, and from what I know, she wasn't really ill, those kind of things. Could you pick it up from there and tell us about that?
Sure. Well, before I even say this, though, I mean, there's a guy named John Armstrong, and I have many of you know about him. He wrote a book called Harvey and Lee. It's a very intriguing theory. I think it's probably at least to some degree true. And his theory is that there were two individuals, one of them from Russia, Harvey, and Lee, the Texas-born guy, who looked enough like each other to be, they were an intelligence project for whatever reason. And eventually that morphed into, the JFK assassination. I don't know that it was ever, it set out to be that way, but it was. But that's, and he has done a lot of research and has convinced a lot of people just from the photographs that there were two Marguerites as well. If you look at the way Oswald's mother, the mother we've seen in history, and I'm talking about Marguerite now, is kind of short and elderly looking, dumpy, not terribly attractive. And the original, the mother that we see like less than 10 years before is taller and kind of a striking woman, right? You know, flashy dresser, looks enough like her to say, well, okay, maybe. But that's the kind of thing, just as Harvey and Lee, if there were two of them, looked enough like each other. But whoever Marguerite Oswald was, the one we know from history, because whoever that other one was disappeared. I don't know, you know, she, if there was two of them. But Marguerite was the only one who was advocating for her son, and she did so right away. And she's the first one. She's the first one who drew attention to the Alkins figure in the doorway, who people now, I think, mistakenly, or at least they shouldn't be absolutely sure that it was Billy Lovelady, who was a co-worker there that looked a lot like Oswald in the picture, but I'm not convinced it is him. I'm not convinced it definitely is Oswald, but at any rate, his mother was, and she, for years, you know, for until her death, she would talk to Jim Mars, one of the great researchers, on a regular basis, and she would always bring that up. You know, that's my son in the doorway. He was in the doorway in a picture. That should have proven his innocence. So she talked about that, and she talked about his record, and she didn't talk about having to come back because of a medical hardship when she obviously didn't have one. There was no reason for that. But she did say that my son worked for the CIA. My son was a government agent. And she was the first one to say this. And she was the first one to talk about a lot of planted evidence, destroyed evidence. And I'll have a lot about this in Hidden History 3, but I think she's been treated unfairly. And consider that so much of it, so much of the negative information about Lee Harvey Oswald goes back to Ruth Payne. Very dubious woman who Oswald's wife was living with in a very curious arrangement at the time of the assassination. She had very strange connections herself and her husband. But so much of the negative information about Oswald, wife beater and all this kind of stuff, goes back to that. And if you people listen to my I Protest show, I had a guy on last Friday who again, interviewed two other people. You already have Buell Fraser, who's been on my show, that talked about Lee's and Harvey Oswald's incredible love for children, how popular he was with kids. For kids all around the Payne neighborhood, when Lee came over on Friday, they'd all come over and gather, so because he would play with them, and they loved him that much. And two other people said the same thing in this book. One of them went to high school with him and then later lived in the same apartment complex with him and talked about, you know, his love for children, how much children loved him. And another woman, the same thing, that was the she was the granddaughter of the woman who rented the rooming house to Lee Harvey Oswald. Again, in a very curious arrangement. He was renting a room and he didn't have much money. It didn't make any sense to me why he would be doing that, closer to his work at the Texas School Book Depository building. But she talked about how much her and her brothers loved Lee Harvey Oswald. He was their favorite tenant, and he would give them advice. And he talked about how sweet and polite. So it's important to see it, because that just counters all the information you hear. And you hear that from a lot of the critics, too, that Bryan DeVincenty was a cold and a wife beater. All that comes from Ruth Payne, pretty much. And so but there's all these other people that talked about him in a completely different way. Marguerite Oswald the same way. I mean, she may have been cantankerous. Maybe she wasn't the most pleasant woman. I don't know. But look what she was dealing with. I mean, this Bob Schieffer, who's his career at CBS for decades after that should have shattered any credibility he had. But most of just like the thing about Oswald comes from Ruth Payne, the myths about Marguerite Oswald come largely from Bob Schieffer, who claimed that she asked for a ride to the police station with him, and all she did was whine and complain. Her son's just been arrested and saying she doesn't have any money and everything. This is ridiculous. And they would perpetuate it again. And the industry throughout have tons of examples of this, of how they continued to say she was a money grabber and all that she charged for. And she was fired instantly after the assassination from her job as like a nurse's aide or something. She couldn't get work anywhere. She was elderly. What was she supposed to do to support herself? The only way she could make money is to sell Lee Harvey Oswald's memorabilia or sell her signature. So I think that's unfair. But at any rate, I think she did a lot of work and a lot of uncredited work. There's the evidence that she tried to help out Helen Markham's son, who was in trouble. And again, I'll have all this in history tree. But yeah, I know I'm probably the only Marguerite Oswald defender out there. Everybody else that I have a soft spot in my heart for, and I think I feel sorry for her, and I think she was treating them terribly.
Now, you brought up Marguerite, you brought up John Armstrong's work. If Marguerite Oswald was possibly two people, and there are now possibly two Oswalds, could you tell us a little more in depth? And you said one was Russian, one was American, most likely. Tell us about the two Lees.
Well, again, the evidence, Armstrong came up with this theory. I don't agree with all of this theory, but he produced a lot of groundbreaking work. And he went back and he found that whoever Lee Harvey Oswald is recorded being at two different public schools in like the eighth or ninth grade or something that are in two parts of the country, two separate areas at the same time. There's school records for him. He talked to Frank Cudlady, who was the principal of Stripling High School. And Cudlady talked about the FBI coming right after the assassination and confiscating all of Oswald's school records.
So the ones we're talking about now, just so I'm clear on it, there was one, say, down south, New Orleans, and another was up in New York, these two?
Well, yeah, that seems to be the general case. But what he did, we're not really sure what this entailed, because obviously the Russian-born kid could speak English well too, but he interviewed people who went to school with the grammar school Lee Harvey Oswald, junior high school, teachers as well, neighbors, students, and they all remembered two different kinds of people. And this is through the Marine Corps as well. He talked to a whole bunch of Marines that apparently served with one, and a whole bunch of Marines that served with the other, because they talked about, you know, you had Carrie Thornley, who was very, very dubious witness himself. I mean, anybody that sets out to write a book about Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination, and that's what he tells us. He's the one that claimed he called himself they called him Private Oswaldovich, and that he carried the daily worker
around. Let's stop
you
for 1 second for the sake of clarity. Sure. For some people who might not understand it, you've made the point well for seasoned researchers, but Thornley, you're saying, wrote a book before the assassination, where Oswald was a major character in it. That's quite interesting.
Yes, he was writing a book about Lee. he was so impressed with Lee Harvey Oswald that he was writing. And again, this is just another Marine. He decides to write a book about him. He wasn't famous yet. This was before the assassination. So Thornley, that was another, you know, I don't want to get too much sidetracked by that, but people can, and I've written a lot about him as well, but he's a very dubious character himself. But if you just look at these school records, if you look at the testimony from people who remember, they remember Lee Harvey Oswald as being outgoing and athletic and a leader of the boys who was getting in fights all the time. And then you remember, no, he was actually quiet and studious and kept to himself and kind of got picked on. Those are the two Oswalds that you see. The sizes are different. And as you know, Jack White, the late, great Jack White, who analyzed all the different faces in the photographs, and there are subtle differences where they don't look the same. They look alike, but they don't look the same. Their features are different and sizes. Oswald's official height fluctuated greatly. So there's, and then, of course, this.
How does a man shrink like that?
Exactly. And it all leads up to, you know, what the most credible source that something was going on are all the impersonations of Lee Harvey Oswald that happened before in the weeks leading up to the assassinations. You know, Sylvia Odio, Albert Guy Bogart at the used car dealership. There were the gun range episode. There were people acting, saying, and they made sure to mention their name was Oswald, that were doing crazy things like on the gun range. This guy claiming it was Oswald shot at the guys next to him's target instead of his own to get attention.
Hey, buddy, I paid right? for that target.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry, buddy. I thought I was shooting at that Kennedy. You know, and that's the kind of stuff.
Was that Garland Slack, if I remember some minutia correct?
Yeah. And again, this is getting the minutia for people, but you can tell. This is something I've been researching for decades, and I'm in that minutia, and I don't want to bore people with it.
Boring. I think it's quite damning of, you know, I mean, the things that were going on. You brought up, you know, when Oswald with Bogart, that story goes back to Oswald test driving a car. Everything seemed to be a magnet to draw attention to him. It wasn't. Could you tell us about Bogart? And I think it's, you know, it's anything but not interesting. I think it's quite interesting.
Yeah, well, Bogart was a used car salesman, and he, again, the only reason he remembered this guy is because he took him for a high speed. And, you know, usually when you go test drive a car with a salesman, you don't wildly speed, but that's what this guy did. And then he came back and he remembered his name Oswald because he wrote it on the back of his business card. And he had people that worked there with him that he would later say when he heard about the assassination and mentioned Oswald's name and he saw him, he said, I guess he won't be needing the car now. And he had witnesses that heard him say that. Now, the important thing here is that the real Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly, we're told, didn't know how to drive. So again, that's another, and we have other people that their references to him driving, to having a license. Oswald had such an interesting documented background that conflicted with other, you know, evidence for a guy that he was just 24 years old. He had led an incredibly full life for somebody who's 20. Remember, this guy, he defected to Russia. He interacts with all these people. He comes back. He renounces his citizenship, is welcomed back with open arms at the height of the Cold War. He isn't debriefed by the CIA, and he enters, he ends up in New Orleans to interact with a bunch of people, and then he winds up in Dallas, and his best friend becomes George de Morenfeld, who is old enough to be his father, and has a background that's, you know, very patrician. I mean, he dated Jackie Kennedy's mother and bounced little baby Jackie on his knee. He had those kind of connections. And he had connections to intelligence, going back to maybe the Nazis. I don't know, he was part of the White Russian community. So he was a very interesting character. And again, it's not believable outside the world of an intelligence operation that somebody that much older, old enough to be his father, would want to befriend this Marxist loser making minimum wage working in a warehouse. It's not like maybe if that had been a Marxist woman, okay, maybe this guy's trying to get sex, okay, maybe that's a motive, but that clearly wasn't the motive here. So,
now, when Oswald was in the service as a Marine, was he trained in the Russian language as a Marine as part of his training?
No. And he
wait, he wasn't trained in Russian?
No, well, he appears to have taught it himself, and then he worked at the top secret at Sugi.
But wasn't there the Warren Commission, the one officer testified about Oswald, and he said he got more questions wrong than he got right on his Russian exam?
Well, yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, but I don't know if he's
and Jim Garrison's dog could have beat him in checkers, I forget.
Yes. But the thing is, see, there's so much conflicting evidence there, because there are people that he interacted with Russia in Russia that said he spoke Russian better than them. There are other people that said, you know, like that guy, or he missed answers on a test and stuff like that. So again, you're not really sure. Even, you know, Marina, her relatives, everybody, they all kind of have different interpretations of how well he spoke Russian. But, you know, again, he was young. Russian is probably, as I understand it, for English speakers, outside of, I guess, like an Asian language, it's the hardest language to learn. And he, you know, apparently had, you know, mastered it pretty well. And so, you know, whether whatever instruction he got out of it, I don't think it came like where he went to the Marines and they decided to instruct him there. But he was clearly, most people, as you know, I think you believe it too, he was part of a false defector program back in those days. So someone, yeah, probably did set him up. Unless, again, if John Armstrong's theory is correct, he already spoke fluent Russian because he was this kid from the Soviet Union. We don't know. But now, somebody
was there anything else in his career in the military that would lead to us to believe that he was used, dangled as a double agent? Was there anything else strange about his career when he was at Atsugi, say the Queen Bee and things like that?
Yeah, well, the Atsugi itself, I mean, that was a top secret. But, you know, that was somebody that was there. I mean, we read, you know, that you had to have a top security clearance to be there. And again, you know, what was he doing there? And yeah, there's the Queen Bee there. And that's another, you have all these stories there that Oswald was kind of this party animal and was a bit of a womanizer. And there was, you know, he was messing with this Queen Bee kind of lady who was very shady herself. But you have other inferences where you have, you know, Rose Sheremy, our, you know, friend, Michael Marchese's mother, who talked about, you know, Oswald shacking up with Jack Ruby. So there are inferences that he was gay like so many other people in this. There's so much about his murky background. That's why when I write about it, I don't conclude anything about Oswald, because it's just a wilderness of mirrors, as he used to talk about the CIA itself. It's so hard to figure out what was going on. That's why John Armstrong could come up with this theory like that, which I don't accept totally, but he found something. Oswald's background is just bizarre, to say. You even have things like John Pick, his half brother, who talked about when he came back from the Marines for a visit, he had not seen him for a couple of years, and he said that's not the brother I remember. And the way he said it was that, you know, he was different.
Well, someone could play with that quote. I agree with you, but someone could play with the quote and say, oh, well, his personality changed. But is that what he meant, what he seemed to mean by that quote?
I don't read it that way. But again, especially when you compare it with, combine it with all the other indications, the way he looked different in pictures, the height fluctuation, all that stuff. It seems to me that it was a pretty clear indication that something weird was afoot there, whether it was John Armstrong's theory or not. But, I mean, the fact that, you know, still getting Oswald's school records has been a difficult thing. And, again, Armstrong's been trying for that for years. But, you know, Oswald is significant in that he was the one that was chosen to be the patsy to describe. But, as you know, I agree with Jim Garrison, who was, I think, because the community, the research community is so fractured and dysfunctional, but I think most good researchers, most knowledgeable researchers now accept Garrison's theory that Lee Harvey Oswald was some kind of an undercover agent, maybe FBI, maybe Naval Intelligence, maybe CIA, maybe all of them. And we know he had a CIA 201 file, supposedly, and that he was, at the time of the assassination, he was on assignment, where he was told to infiltrate a group that he was told was planning to assassinate the president. And that group would have included the people you saw in Oliver Stone's movie. Clay Shaw, Jack Ruby, David Ferry, the anti-Castro Cubans, all of those people who I don't think any of them were real conspirators. I think they, in my opinion, I think they were all being manipulated. And we know Jack Ruby was an FBI informant. So, and we know Clay Shaw was a CIA operative.
Well, they might have been working at a lower level.
Exactly, a lower level. And I personally think, to me, it seemed to be ingenious if they just told all of them, hey, you're infiltrating a plot to, I think they all were probably infiltrating what they were told was a plot to kill the president. That's my belief. And they used
it. Or obviously, like, they use the term sheep dipped. So when they're talking about sheep dipped, it's making one person look like another person or reasoning, their reasoning different than their actual reasoning. Could it have been part of the plot in New Orleans with Clay Shaw and Guy Bannister to, quote, sheep dip Oswald?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's what they were doing. And again, you look at Oswald's connections, you had watched JFK, the movie, and you had the great scene. And what's over there?
I haven't
there?
Seen
what's
it yet, there? But tonight I think I might pop some corn.
Yeah, maybe you can. Maybe
I thought you and the son could sit around in your house and we'll start it simultaneously. And then you just mute me so I don't annoy you when you watch it, but make believe you're still on the phone with me. No, I kid. But as we get into the JFK movie and the characters in it, one of the most fascinating things to me is on the show, we had a guest, and without you, that wouldn't have been possible. You've known him through personal connections in your family. Would you like to tell us about the person you met him through in your family and the person of whom I speak?
Yeah, my brother, Ricky, who died almost a year ago.
So we're very sorry about that.
I know. I think I appreciate that. And I've written a lot about it and talked a lot about it. It's very close to me, but he happened to meet this guy and, again, he was in a program that helped him get housing and helped him out and stuff. And, he met this other guy who was in the program, a similar program. And, he told me his name's Dean Andrews III. He said his dad was a lawyer in New Orleans connected to Jim Garrison. And I said, I figured, no, it can't be the same guy. But anyhow, he ended up coming over to my house and he brought a scrapbook from the jazz festival. And I knew Dean Andrews Jr., the beatnik lawyer. People don't know is the guy that was played very memorably by John Candy in Oliver Stone's JFK. And again, very cool language, daddy-o and, got the right tie-pie, the wrong toe-toe or whatever. And, very,
you want to stop eating that crab meat for a minute and tell me more about him?
Yeah, that's right. And so Dean became a friend of the family, a very good friend. And I still, talk to him still occasionally. He was my brother's best friend, probably. And we had him on the show. We interviewed him, I guess it's been a month or so ago. And the first time he's really not been on the record And it's important because he's an insider and he can tell what he went through and how that destroyed his family. And he talked about his dad being so paranoid. And of course, Dean Andrews Jr. would end up lying and committing perjury because he wanted to save his own ass. I mean, I guess he had natural human emotion, motive, because he saw people, dropping all around him, and he didn't want to be that. But behind closed doors, thanks to his son, I know that he, was very paranoid, and he knew it was a conspiracy, and he didn't want them to get him. So, very interesting connection for me. And I tell people, there are coincidences, and that there are coincidences in life because that is a coincidence. I didn't, there's, I don't know what the odds are that he would have come to Virginia, and wound up in the program with my brother. So, but anyhow, he's become a good friend, and he's really my connection to the JFK assassination. And I know you were intrigued by him as well, but he's
thanks to you, I got to speak to him. I appreciate that very much. But he's an interesting guy, and he's interesting just beyond these circumstances. But he had talked about his dad's background in World War II. I didn't realize he basically Dean Andrews. Would have been a war hero by any account. The missions he flew at a very high mortality rate for anybody in them, and his background would lead one to believe he could be an intelligence as Dean as Dean told us when he was on. Would you want to fill in the gap in my little tale there a little bit?
Yeah, well, that's what Dean said. But, you know, he was, I think he called him an asset, was it? Is that what he called him? An asset as opposed to an operative? But
see, what I'm trying to do now is not comment because I got confused. But I confess my confusion. There was a difference between an asset who would, I believe, was that the one where you're in the community, he served in the military, he had a high clearance, he's one of their own, and then you would have somebody like a David Ferry or somebody at the low end of the spectrum who they wouldn't protect it, basically. I think that I got it straight there. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think he said he was an asset, which would be they used him in some way. And I think there's, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald was one of his clients who notoriously he was after for money because Oswald was kind of a deadbeat and didn't pay him his attorney fees. But he was also trying to help what he called the gay, you know, the gay community, which is kind of odd. He used that term back then. It wasn't known then for all the, you know, homosexuals and the anti-Castro. Apparently there was a bunch of them. And those are the clients that were, and again, I think they were in that milieu. They were in that, that, as, where some of them could be tied to Oswald and Ferry and all that. And I, to me, I think that's all a smokescreen because I don't think there was any kind of Castro connection to the assassination because I said many times before, if the reason Kennedy was killed was to start another Bay of Pigs or because he wouldn't try to overthrow Castro, it certainly was a failure because after the assassination, no one ever tried to again. And in fact, Cuba died as a campaign issue in America. LBJ never tried it. Nixon never tried it. No one did. I mean, Cuba, it was only during the Kennedy years. And so I think that was a smokescreen. And I think all those, it's kind of misleading. That's why I don't look too much at all the anti-Castro stuff, because I think they were part of this fake milieu that was built up around and which Oswald was embroiled in because that's where he was assigned to.
Well, in a letter... I didn't mean to interrupt you, but in a letter that we had seen recently that was between Oliver Stone and Fletcher Prouty, Fletcher Prouty brought up something I never would have thought of. They had Operation Mongoose as after the Bay of Pigs set up where there were training camps, and Dean, your friend, came on and he described how he was brought to the training camps a few times by his dad, and that was going on. But Operation Mongoose, Prouty was writing to Stone in his letter saying that basically that might have been part of the link where they trained some of the people using the assassination, but it's so duplicitous, as you're stating, that it could wind up being like another diversion. It just seemed there were so many mirrors in this funhouse, you know, that it's fun and games, man. You just can't get to the bottom of it. But as we conclude on Dean, we have about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to talk about something more personal to you. You mentioned your brother. I'd like to take the next 10 minutes, whatever you'd like to say and tell us as you, you know, remember your brother. And I could tell as being your friend how the great affection you held for your brother and what he meant to you. And I'd just like to hand it over and just any thoughts you have on him and anything you'd like to remember.
Oh, I appreciate that, Bob. Obviously, he meant a great deal to me. And since he died, like I said, there's an empty spot in my life. The death of my parents didn't affect me as much. And I was largely kind of not his caretaker, but I was involved a lot with him. And if people want to read, they can go to my Substack, DonaldJeffries.substack.com. I just wrote a piece yesterday. It's very personal, but it also has the JFK assassination, too, because the odd thing about it is it's called, and it's DonaldJeffries.substack.com, and it's I Protest, and it's called JFK, Thanksgiving, and My Brother's Downfall. And I talk about how it was a long time until I figured out that this thing happened the exact same day as the JFK assassination. Basically, the two most significant events in my life, certainly in my early life, happened on November 22nd, 1963. One, obviously, is the assassination of JFK. It's where my memories pretty much start from, you know, from that day and a constant stream. But I knew that my brother had this horrible situation in high school, which really made no sense at all. People can read about it. It was an incredibly minor incident that happened to him, and he was harassed and persecuted beyond belief. He was expelled from school. He had to go live with my sister. Our whole family was uprooted. I was 7 years old, and I didn't really understand what had happened. I thought he had murdered somebody. I didn't understand it. And I just knew that I wasn't supposed to tell people, and I was so terrified they were, you know, going to find out what was going on, even though I didn't know what was going on. But I go through the details in the Substack article, and but the most amazing thing is years later, I was able to verify that it happened on November 22nd, 1963. So, you know, an incident that formed my political philosophy, and people can read about it to see it, it had an impression on me at 7 years old because, you know, I first saw how the system was so unfair and everything was rigged. And my antipathy for the rich and powerful, it all came from that incident. I now realize that. I can armchair psychoanalyze myself very easily and see that. So, my feelings about JFK, it's all kind of now meshed together in what happened to my brother. And even Thanksgiving, because it was right around Thanksgiving. So these feelings really come back to me then, because it's a great time. We're giving thanks, but I can't help thinking about that. So you know, just like the JFK assassination, I don't know if I'll ever get the answers for that. And I know Oswald didn't do it. I know they lied to us, but will we ever know who the exact gunmen were? I doubt it. You know, though I'd love to have a time machine to go back and film behind, watch a video behind the grassy, you know, the picket row, fence of the grassy knoll, and also on the sixth floor window of the Texas School Depository Building to see exactly what was going on then, to follow Oswald afterwards and just see to the extent what was, you know, how much we were lied to. But, you know, I'd also like to have a time machine to go back to what happened to my brother in high school that day, because that story seems just as unbelievable to me as well on a personal level. Obviously, it had no impact for the country. So those two together, it's just bizarre that they both happened the same day and they're two of the most pivotal events, you know, next to my marriage and the birth of my children, which were the highlights. Those were kind of the lowlights, I guess. And they both happened on the same day when I was 7 years old. So, again, people can read the details. It's a long, convoluted story, and we go over time if I went. But again, it's my brother was—he was a rich father. Just, you know, took a very little thing he did that should have warranted detention, and they prosecuted him. And I really don't even know what they prosecuted him for. I don't know, but anyway, he was expelled from school. He had to live away from home, and it affected him mentally. And from that day forward, he was never the same, because up until that point, I didn't think there was anything so-called wrong with my brother. I thought he was, quote, normal. After that, I never did. And his life was ruined by that one incident. It's tragic. And I you know, if that hadn't happened, I don't know that, you know, he might have got married and had kids. He might have been successful. I don't know. But I know what happened afterwards. And that, and it also put a burden on me, because basically not long after that, it didn't take long for me to become the older brother, even though I was 8 years younger. He was a teenager. I was seven. And I ended up becoming the older brother, and that's the role I played the rest of his life, because he needed help and nobody else wanted to help him. So anyhow, I hope that answers it. I know, but it's a very personal thing, but I mean, if people, it's, you know, I think it's worth a read. You know, to read it in Substack, and maybe you'll find some other stuff that's interesting there. But it's more personal. But I do tie it in with the JFK assassination, so it's kind of an interesting mixture there.
Well, it's most definitely worth a read. All your articles are worth a read. As a friend, it pains me to say you're very talented. But you are. You've done a great job on those articles, and I know what you went through. You know, I've heard the anguish in your voice at the time that, you know, you went through that, and many times since, and it's definitely worth delving into. Now, you have so many, besides your articles, you have so many books and podcasts and stuff coming on. You want to clue us in again, what are the next upcoming books, the recent ones? And I think one of them has something to do with the Beatles, if I'm correct. Am I correct about that?
Yes, and I have a little co-author. I can't remember his name. You and I worked on that together, Bob Wilson. It was your idea. It's called From Abbey Road to From Strawberry Fields to Alley Road, the Billy Shear story, and we got a bunch of celebrities, and you know, I have my little celebrity contingent, and you know, we're famous ones, maybe they're not anymore, but I love them. You know, Susan Olsen from the Brady Bunch played Cindy Brady. Sally Kirkland has been an actress in many things. Nick Mancuso, an actor in many things. John Probus, who played Timmy on Lassie. Well, lots of people like that. And you got a couple people from Wings. We got a guy from Love and Spoonful. You got a lot of genuine experts in this area.
Our good friend Vera Ramone from Queens, New York.
Vera Ramone. Yeah. So there's, it's full of, and basically it's, it devised a set of series of questions to ask them about the Beatles, the impact the Beatles had on their lives. And we asked them about the Paul is Dead controversy. Now, as it turns out, I think we thought maybe there might be a few in there that, you know, we thought there'd be more doubt. It's like there is some, but I think I go over that in my introduction as well, because there's a reason you and I think agree that the Beatles did put those clues out there on purpose. I don't think they happened accidentally. So people can read about it, and there's the history of that. It's very interesting. And who knows, you know, it's nothing's impossible, but it's interesting to read how all those people found out and the genesis of where that legend was born. And it's, you know, it's very, you know, there's just going to be one little thing. I mean, just the, you and I think, again, we don't want to believe that, but when Paul McCartney was interviewed, he mentioned about the Abbey Road cover and people seeing the four of them are walking across the road. And he's very famously is not wearing shoes. And of course, you know, he's the corpse and John Lennon's the minister and George is the undertaker. And I think Ringo is the, I don't know what the hell Ringo was, the mourner, I guess, or something. But so
he's a coroner. He was. But we also got for the book, one of the originators of the actual myth itself, Fred Labor. We were fortunate enough that at about the 11th hour, he came in and gave us a nice interview.
Yeah, and that's so, you know, you'll learn all you need to know about this. And I, who knows, maybe you'll think there's something to it. I don't know. But I found that, you know, McCartney's explanation for why he wasn't wearing shoes is that he was wearing flip-flops and it was hot that day. That just kind of adds, you know, fuel to the fire because, you know, if the asphalt was too hot to wear flip-flops, wouldn't it have been even much hotter to go barefoot? So that was, I don't know if he did it on purpose or what. So that's kind of stuff you'll find in the book.
Well, in any event, what you say, we're not necessarily saying he was bumped off or he was killed in an accident, but we do sort of think that a good number of the clues might have been manufactured for a little bit of an inside joke and publicity stunt.
And
our celebrity friends came in and shared their memories.
Right.
So we have about 1 minute left here on the Shake and Wake Network. We're going to give you a little shake so you wake. So as you can close us out, Don, tell us about the next Hidden History book, where they can look for that one. And we always want to give a shout out to Ben Omar of Bear Manor Media, don't we, Don?
Absolutely. He'll be publishing the Beatles book. And Hidden History 3 is with the publisher now. We'll see. Hopefully they publish it. I also have a book coming out on COVID. That's going to be coming out soon, too. I have a publisher lined up for that, too, but it's not there yet. I protest, again, on Substack, Donald Jeffries at Substack.com. The website is DonaldJeffries.media. My weekly show on Roxin.com airs from every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern. Is also called I Protest. So, and all my books are out there. So you can search for me, and you'll probably find out more than you need to know or more than you want.
Well, Don is a proficient author of magazines and books. He's got his podcast, and he always says yes to be on people's shows because he loves it when they ask him and they care about his work. Although when I first asked today, he said, maybe. And on that note, we leave you with Don Jeffries, Steve Roberts, and our upcoming Beatles book, which has some hidden history in it. And on that note, here at Don't Pass Me By, we'll see you next time.